Judges chapter 8 then, we'll start a few verses back, Judges 7 verse 24 to the end. Chapter 8, let's start with a very well-known song. We'll start at the very beginning, if I quote one song, and then go straight to another song from The Sound of Music. You know the song, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria? I was hoping someone would shout out to her. No, it wasn't likely, was it? How do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you catch a cloud and pin it down? Come on, you do know these words. I'm sure you do. How do you find a word that means Maria? Flibbertigibbet, a will-o'-wisp. Come on, you know what comes next, don't you? A clown. I bet there are loads of you who know all the words to that song and all the rest of The Sound of Music. On the one hand, with Maria, remember what they say? She's not an asset to the abbey. She's always getting in trouble, isn't she? But then one of the other nuns pops out and she says, but Maria makes me laugh. I sort of keep flipping between the good stuff, Maria, and the bad stuff. And they say, how do you pin Maria down? She's just a bit of an enigma, isn't she? In many respects, I would like to slot Gideon into that same category as Maria. Gideon in the Bible, I think, is a very complicated figure to figure out. If you were with us this morning, we saw chapter 6. We saw what happened there with Gideon. And he's quite straightforward there. He's this shy, timid, retiring sort of character that needs to be coaxed into this position of leadership to serve God because he's nervous and he's afraid and he needs reassurance. And that's quite straightforward. I can understand that. And the same is true in chapter 7. I know we didn't read chapter 7, but in that chapter where he actually goes and fights the Midianites, again, it's this story of this weak, scared man who not only is he weak, but his army is weak and his weapons are weak, but they overcome the enemy with God's hand. Again, we can slot that into a nice, simple, yeah, I understand that. When we come to Judges chapter 8, I think Gideon is so much more of a complicated figure. In a moment, we'll just work through this series of events that we just read. They may not be that familiar to you. I know this isn't on a par with your David and Goliath, your Daniel in the lion's den sort of stories. You may well think, well, I'm not sure I've heard these stories before. But at the same time, I think the stories themselves aren't really difficult to understand on one level. It's not that difficult to understand what's actually happening, I don't think. I trust we'll see that. But what's really hard is sort of ask the question, how am I supposed to interpret this? What am I supposed to do with this little story here? What am I to make of it? Read some people who write about Gideon, and they want to see Gideon in Judges chapter 8 as being a hero. So they sort of cast everything he does in the light of, well, it's almost as if, well, Gideon did it. It must be right. So they're always looking for the great thing Gideon does. So everything he does is good and honourable and right. And then you read other people, and they've just written him off as this rogue. And so they put a negative interpretation on everything Gideon does. Well, he can't be trusted. He's insincere. He does everything for his own glory. He abuses every little bit of power he gets. And be honest, there's times when I think both of those things are true with Gideon. And then there are times as well where even in this chapter I just think, I don't think it's clear enough to make any sort of judgment about the man himself. There are times when I think he seems to be trying to do the right thing, but then a moment later you want to sort of slap your forehead and say, no, Gideon. But you know what, actually, I don't think any of this should surprise us. Gideon's not a one-dimensional character. He's not a goodie. He's not a baddie. He doesn't get everything right. He doesn't get everything wrong. Sometimes he has good intentions. Sometimes he lets his own sinful desires get the better of him. Actually, it does come back to what we were saying if you were with us this morning. It's not, actually, he's just like us, isn't he? He's just like me, and he's just like you. He's not a goodie as such. He's not a paddy. He's much more complicated than that. So we're going to walk through these main stories. I've broken it into five main events that happen, and then we'll try and untangle these events and what we think is going on, and then we'll draw one big lesson at the end. So the lesson comes at the end tonight. So let's look at the first one. It's Gideon and the Ephraimites. That's chapter 7, verse 24. It goes into chapter 8, verse 3. Chapter 7, verse 24, chapter 8, verse 3. So Gideon, we've said, has just led the people to fight against the Midianites, this oppressive nation who was trying to ruin everything in Israel, taking their crops, as we saw this morning. So chapter 7, verse 24, he sends a message to the people of Ephraim. Come and join us. Come and help us. Come and seize the land together. And they do. Chapter 7, verse 25, they seize these two Midianite princes, Oreb and Zeb, and they kill them. Chapter 8, verse 1, they say to Gideon, they basically complain to him. They say, why didn't you call us in the first place? Why didn't you involve us sooner? So in verses 2 and 3, Gideon has to sort of play the role of a diplomat and try and calm things down a bit. And he says, what have I done compared to you? And he says, the grapes of Ephraim produce something much better than the vintage of Abiezer. Abiezer is Gideon's own family tree. So what he's basically saying there is that in you killing these two Midianite priests, you've done something far more glorious and wonderful than all the stuff I did in the battle. So chapter 8, verse 3, their anger subsides. Gideon has managed to calm them down. Now, do you see what I mean? I say, okay, it's fine. I understand what they're saying, but what do you make of that little story? What are we supposed to do with it? He's being accused of not involving the Ephraimites and inviting them to come and join the battle. Well, was there a good reason? Was it lack of judgment on Gideon's behalf? Did he not involve them? Because, sometimes we want to do something ourselves because we get all the glory for it. But if someone else helps us, then we have to give some of the credit. So is that what's going through his mind? Yours? I don't know. I don't know what's going on in Gideon's head here. I don't know what he's motivated by. And we're just not told. I think we are meant to learn something from that, which we will come to at the end. So for that one, I don't know. Maybe you do. Maybe you can figure this out and you can tell me afterwards. I just can't. I don't know. Secondly, Gideon and Succoth and Penuel. That's verses 4 to 17. Gideon with Succoth and Penuel. So in chapter 8, verse 4, Gideon and his 300 men carry on the pursuit of these fleeing Midianites. But they're exhausted, so they go to this town called Succoth, and they ask him for some bread in verse 5 so they can continue their chase. But in verse 6, the leaders of Succoth basically say, well, look, have you caught them yet? In other words, if you've not caught them yet, we're going to stay neutral here. We're not going to help you, Gideon, because if you don't catch them and then they turn around and defeat you, we're in trouble because we've supported you. We're just going to wait and see how all this plays out. We're not going to help you now, Gideon. So verse 7, Gideon's furious. He promises, I'm going to come back after I've defeated them and I'm going to tear your flesh with thorns. And then the same thing happens with Penuel, verse 8 and 9. And he says the same thing to them. I'm going to come back after the war and I'm going to tear down your tower. And that's what happens. Verses 10 to 12, he goes, he finds these two kings, the Midianite kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. He captures them. Verse 13, he comes back from the battle. Verse 14, he discovers who the leaders of the towns are. And then verse 15, he takes these kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. So here you go, look, I've got them now. There you go. Verse 16, he then takes the elders of the city. And it says he taught the men of Succoth. It says he taught them. It doesn't mean he sat down and taught them maths or anything like that. What he's saying there is he whipped them with cords. He taught them a lesson. That sort of teaching. And in verse 17, he goes to Penuel. He tears down their tower. It says he kills the men of the city. Same thing again. What's going on here? I don't know about you. I find these sorts of events. Yeah, I can understand what's happening, but this is such a different culture to us. All this is so different to anything we experience in our life at the moment. What are we to make of it? So a couple of things we can say here. Succoth and Penuel should have supported Gideon. Because Gideon is God's chosen deliverer. The Midianites are the oppressors. They're the enemy. They're oppressing Israel. And by refusing to give Gideon's army food, they're siding with the enemy. They're taking sides against God. That's what they're doing. So in that sense, Gideon has a right to say, look, what you're doing is wrong here. But does he have a right to punish, to whip them, to tear down their tower and to kill them? Well, no, they're Israelites. He's not been told he's allowed to do this by God. And actually, you get a feel of what's motivating him in verse 15. That's what he said, "Here are Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me." You know, sometimes people mock us and they take the mick out of us. What does it do? It just spurs us on, "I'll prove you wrong." That seems to be what's driving Gideon, his own pride. "Who do you think you are saying that about me? I'll show you." And then he does come back and he does show them. So he doesn't really come out of here, you know, looking particularly good either. Then there's the third story. You've got Gideon with Zebah and Zalmunna themselves, these two Midianite kings. That's verses 18 to 21. Turns out there's a little bit of a backstory to all this. In verse 18, Gideon asks them who they killed at Tabor. This is the first thing we've ever heard of that. And they say, well, the men we killed were a lot like Gideon, a lot like you. They resembled the son of a king. In verse 19, Gideon says, well, look, yeah, they did resemble me. They're my brothers. You killed my brothers. And then notice what he says. If you hadn't killed my brothers, I wouldn't be about to kill you. So he tells his firstborn son to kill them. Again, this is one of these big cultural differences. This is actually a privilege, what he's doing there. His firstborn son gets the honour of killing these Midianite kings. He gets the scalps. It was a great thing he was giving to his son there. I know we find that strange in our day and age, but he's been kind. And when his son's too scared, Gideon arises and does it himself. Again, though, notice what's motivating Gideon at this point. It's revenge for his brothers. He specifically says, I'm only killing you because of what you did to my brothers. That makes you wonder, what's motivating him throughout all of these events? Why is he leading this band of 300 men in hot pursuit of the Midianites? Why is he doing everything he's doing? Is he motivated by serving God? Or is he motivated by revenge for his brothers? And we're not told, but I suspect it's probably a mixture of the two. That would be my best guess. It seems that maybe the sense in which sometimes Gideon does the right thing, but from the wrong motive. Okay, fourthly, Gideon with all the people. Gideon and the people, that's verses 22 to 27. So look at verse 22. "The men of Israel, and they come and they ask Gideon to rule over them." They're asking him to be the king. And not only that, to start a new line, a hereditary kingship, because they say, well, after you, we want your son to be king. And after him, we want his son to be king as well. In verse 23, Gideon refuses. He declines the throne. It doesn't happen very often, does it? I'm glad Steve's back as our resident historian. Steve, has it happened much in British history? It has happened once, hasn't it? I think that's a knowing nod from Steve rather than a terrified, don't put me on the spot again, sort of nod. It happened once, 1657, after the English Civil War. It's Oliver Cromwell. He was offered the throne, abolished the monarchy, and he agonised over it for several weeks, and he said, no. He said something interesting, actually, in terms of Bible knowledge. He said, he's talking about the monarchy, he said, I would not build Jericho again. He's quoting elsewhere in the Bible there. So it does happen, but very rarely. So Gideon says no. And I think he's right to say no. Notice the reason he gives in verse 23. Well, it's because the Lord shall rule over you. So he's giving a theological reason. God's not appointed me as king. It's not for me, or indeed for Israel, just to choose who gets to rule over God's people. No, that's up to God to decide. He's not appointed me as king. So again, he says no. But why does he say no? You know, some people would say no to being king because you can think of nothing worse than having to be a king. I know you think it sounds great, but actually, would you want to be a part of the royal family? Would you want to have to go and do all these engagements and be polite to people all the time? I'm just thinking about today's royal family. I don't think I'd want to be a part of it. You know, maybe you would. Good for you. There's different questions here we can ask about Gideon's motives for saying no. Because he says no, then he goes on and behaves as if he is the king. So look at verse 24. Straight away, he asks everyone to give him golden earrings that they plundered from the Midianites. Verse 26, he has these crescent ornaments, the purple robes the Midianite kings have been making. He even, later on, towards the end of the chapter, he calls one of his sons Abimelech. You know what Abimelech means? It means my father is king. Well, why would you call your son my father is king unless you want to be known as the king informally, at least? See what I mean about these contradictions? He says he doesn't want the throne, and then he behaves as if he does on the throne. So he takes all these things, these earrings, these ornaments and so on. In verse 27 he makes an ephod. An ephod was something a high priest would wear. It's expensive, made of lots of colourful materials, precious metal, gold, stones and so on, and it'd be used to ask God for guidance. But I don't think that's what this is talking about. I don't think it's a good thing. Seems like an ephod could also be some sort of sheet you could drape over an idol. And that seems to be more likely. So if you look at verse 27, it's told, Israel played the harlot there. In other words, Israel went after other gods, turned away from the one true God. I don't know if that was Gideon's intention or not, but that's what happened. I suspect at least one aspect of him doing this, though, is that he's doing this for his personal glory. Think about this ephod he makes. He makes it from the spoils of war that he himself won in the war. You know, he led that war and he won it. It's erected as his instructions, and then, verse 27, he places it in his hometown. Why would you do that? Well, for the same reason people like Lenin and Stalin have enormous statues of themselves. Saddam Hussein, people like that. Why would you have a statue of yourself built in your hometown? Well, so people can all say how great you are. So they can remember what a brilliant leader you were. So everyone can talk about how great Gideon is. So I think his pride's got the better of him again here. Leads Israel astray. Told it becomes a snare to Gideon and to his household too. And then the fifth very brief incident is Gideon's legacy. Chapter 8, verses 28 to 35, Gideon's legacy. As you'd expect, as you read these final verses about him, his legacy is mixed. On the one hand, verse 28, the Midianites are subdued. The country's quiet for 40 years. Think back to where you started, if you were here with us this morning, chapter 6. The Midianites, like these locusts coming in, and everyone's terrified, and they're taking all the crops and so on. It's hard for Israel just to keep going. They're this awful, oppressive enemy. Well, now, there's rest. 40 years of rest. Well, that's good. But then Gideon himself has pursued sins of various types. We're told in verse 30, he had many wives, lots of wives. And in verse 31, he has a concubine as well. In other words, a woman who's not his wife, but is just there for him to use, to have sex with. He's got a concubine too. He shouldn't have done those things. On the flip side, Gideon's presence seems to have restrained evil in the nation. Notice in verse 33, as soon as Gideon was dead, the children of Israel go back to playing the harlot with the idols, with the Baals again. He seems to have been in some way restraining these things. His very presence is when he dies that they go off again. And in verse 35, reminded of the good that Gideon had done for Israel. That's where it finishes. He did good. He did good for Israel. You know, you can't just write him off as someone who did all these bad things. So can you see now why? I just think Gideon is such a complicated character. At times he does great things, he acts bravely, he fights the Midianites, he wins this battle, he rescues his people from slavery and oppression. Times he acts with humility, says, no, I'm not going to be king. No, the throne is not for me. God alone should lead his people. And then there's times when he just seems consumed with his own interests. He thinks he's got the right to kill people who stand in his way. He seems to want all the trappings of power. He wants to act like the king without actually having all the rigmarole of being the formal king. Times when he seems to do the right thing for the wrong reason. There are times when you can't really work out what's going on in his head at all. And maybe he can't either. So how do you solve a problem like Gideon? Remember what they say about Maria in the song? She's a darling. No, she's a demon. She's a lamb. They sing she's unpredictable as weather. She's as flighty as a feather. I think, yeah, tweak the wording a little bit. I think you've got Gideon in that song. So how do you solve the problem? Well, I think we solve it by saying what we said this morning. Gideon is a man just like us. We can't put him up on a pedestal, we can't applaud everything he does, because he gets stuff so badly wrong, he damages the nation so much. But we can't condemn him either. His legacy talks about the good things he did for Israel. He's in Hebrews 11, he's a man of faith, a hero of the faith. With Gideon, he keeps flitting between the desire to dominate other people and trying to do the right thing. Switches from being scared and timid, as we saw in chapter 6, to abusing others, grabbing power, wanting to kill them. You couldn't trust him. I always think, you read the Bible and you think, well, what sort of Gideon are we going to get today? What's he going to do next? He does one thing one minute, and then something so out of keeping with what you thought the next. And I suspect, actually, he couldn't trust himself either. So even when he had good intentions, so desperate for power, grabbing power, even when he said no to being king. Why is all that significant? I think it's significant for this reason. With Gideon, you've got the really detailed picture of our own hearts. You know, we'd say, and we rightly believe in the Bible, when the Bible tells us, we take it seriously, don't we? The heart is deceitful above all things. And you see Gideon, you think, yeah, he really is like that, isn't he? You know, we deceive ourselves. We tell ourselves, yeah, I'll be all right. I'll do the right thing. And then the moment actually comes to it, and we do something completely different. I mean, but I had such good intentions. What happened? Where did it come from? Well, that's what my heart is like. You see that in Gideon's life. That moment comes, and you sort of thought to yourself, I'm going to tell the truth. I've got to say it. I've got to speak the truth here. And then the moment actually comes, and the urge comes, I think, I ended up just protecting my own interests. I didn't say what I'd planned to say. I didn't own up. Now we find ourselves thinking, I am going to do that thing. I know it would be kind if I did such and such a thing for them. I know I should be selfless and I'll put them first, and we have such good intentions, and then what actually happens, the spur of the moment comes, and I ended up just thinking up entirely about myself. I did the thing that I didn't plan to do. You know, Gideon can't trust his own heart here. He keeps flipping from different in different directions. So we've got to take it seriously. I can't even trust my own heart. And yet the wonderful thing with Gideon is that he has real faith. We're told he's a man of faith. And that faith really does transform his life. It informs his thinking. He is a tremendous force for good in the life of Israel. So don't write yourself off as thinking, well, how can I even trust my own heart? What's the point of doing anything? The wonderful thing is that when God saves people and uses them and forgives them, he does it even though he can see what you're like, warts and all. You know, Israel did need a king. We say Gideon didn't accept the offer to be the king. Do you know, even if he had done, he wasn't actually the king Israel needed. Because he was so inconsistent. Imagine having a king like him. Imagine if he actually ruled that country. He'd make a rule one minute, And then he'd just cancel it out the next. And you'd be caught out. He'd have been an awful king, really. He might have done some good things. Do you know what? All the ways that the judges, the deliverers, the saviours of Israel that you read about in Judges, they all do one thing for us. They point us towards the one great deliverer. See, with Gideon, what I think comes out really clearly is that he points us towards what I think is possibly the most understated, underrated doctrine of the Christian faith. It's the one that we talk very little about, but it's actually essential. We're going to finish with this just for the last few minutes. It's the doctrine of Jesus Christ's immutability. You might think, well, what does that mean, immutability? It's the term that theologians use to describe Jesus' consistency. The fact that he does not change. Jesus is immutable. Now, if you don't remember that, if you just find yourself throughout the week thinking, what was that word? It was in something of all or other. I'm not worried about whether you remember the word or not. But I do want you to think about what it actually means. There's a well-known verse. It says, Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It's a verse that we like to quote. I don't know about you, when I hear that verse, I find it very comforting. It's a very reassuring verse to hear. But we need to think about why. What is it about that that is so reassuring? It's that the immutability of Jesus Christ is so essential for us. Imagine just for a moment a saviour that God sends into the world who one moment reaches the dizzy heights of sinless perfection. But the next minute, he's squabbling and losing his temper and falling out with people. Imagine a saviour who one moment is carrying out great acts of selfless love for his people, and the next minute, he's renounced his love. No, I don't love those people after all. He's changed his mind. Imagine a Jesus who's so approachable one moment. Yeah, anybody can come to him and talk to him, and bring their burdens to him. And he's so patient, so approachable. And the next minute he's just showing you a cold shoulder. No, too busy for you now. Imagine a saviour who's promised to prepare a place for you. Promise that if you put your faith in him, he will take you home. He's preparing it even now, and it's a promise for you. And then the very next day, he's just lost interest in his promise, almost forgotten he's even made it, just moved on to other things. Imagine a saviour who promises to save you and is just so easily influenced, leaned on, pressured, like we can be sometimes. You know, we think something's just right, we're sure we're going to do it, and then all it takes is for someone to say a single sentence, we're off in a different direction. Think of any aspect of your faith, if you're a Christian, any promise Jesus has made, anything he's told you he's done for you, and then think about the effect it would have if Jesus was as changeable and as flaky as Gideon is and as we are. So, no, if it was not for the immutability, the unchanging nature of Jesus Christ, you and I would have no hope whatsoever. So if you remember nothing else from tonight, remember this. If you put your trust in Jesus, you have a saviour who is reliable. A saviour who keeps his promises. A saviour who is consistent in everything he does. As we sang at the start of the service, there is no shadow of turning with thee. And we can say that just as equally about Jesus Christ as the Son of God as we can about God himself. If it was not for that doctrine, our faith would be meaningless, because we just don't know what Jesus is going to do tomorrow. You know, Jesus has a heart that's just made of different stuff to Gideon. A heart that's not been corrupted by sin. You read about Gideon. What does he do? He beats up the people of God with thorns. He teaches them a lesson. He does it with thorns. Jesus doesn't beat up his people with thorns, but he does serve them by wearing a crown of thorns. One of the things Gideon used to build an ephod was his own robes. He builds an idol so everyone can see how great he is. Jesus at the cross, he doesn't have his own robes to protect his dignity. He's stripped naked. His clothes are divided. He's taken by those soldiers. There's no great statue of Jesus erected in his hometown of Bethlehem. Instead, what does he have? A sign above his head. The King of the Jews. A mocking sign. Gideon just can't help but grab the glory for himself when he sees half a chance. He just seems to not be able to help himself when he sees it. What does Jesus do? Makes himself of no reputation. Suffers the humiliation at the cross. At every point, consistently at the cross, he is giving himself for us. And that's what qualifies him to be the true king. It's precisely these things that mean he's worthy of worshipping. Precisely these things that he's able to do what Gideon could never do, what we can never do for ourselves, to rescue us from our own sin. That's what sets Jesus Christ apart as unique. His consistency in his perfection. His consistency in his holiness. His consistency in his love. His consistency in his giving himself for us.